Lots of health issues, both physical and mental, are shared by all age groups, but some become more acute as we age. Aside from the fact that our bodies are showing the wear and tear of years, our social situations are often changing later in life. The faces of the people we once used to see on a regular basis are no longer around. Isolation is frequently a concern of and about seniors, and there is ever clearer evidence that that isolation can indeed lead to depression. It is pointed up in a recent report in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society called "Does Mode of Contact with Different Types of Social Relationships Predict Depression in Older Adults?" Evidence from a nationally representative survey. The lead author of that is Dr. Alan Teo, the assistant professor and assistant professor of psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University and a researcher at the VA Portland Healthcare System. He's our guest on The Exchange. Dr. Teo, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate the opportunity.
So we get a steady stream of studies and reports and papers and surveys. Can you tell us a bit about the methodology here?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a study where we drew data from about 11,000 older adults. Those are people that were over age 50, and they're coming from all over the United States. And these are individuals who participate in this survey on a regular basis every 2 years. They do interviews and they do written surveys. And from that data, we were able to gather this information on both their depression risk as well as some of their social life. And again, particularly what was interesting to me was how people have contact with their friends and family.
How, in terms of the actual method of communication?
Exactly so. Yeah, so we've known for a long time that having social contact is good for your health. As you pointed out, social isolation on the flip side is bad for your health. But we haven't really been able to drill down into does it matter so much whether it's on the phone like we're doing now or in person or other modes of connecting.
Is the sense of isolation, is the concern about it greater for seniors than for any other age group?
I think that there's been two big age groups that we have worried about in the research world or that a lot of research studies have been done on, and that is the older adult population. There's also a lot of concern, I think, on the flip side, among young, you know, the youth, millennials and things like that. So this the reason that we looked at older adults is, again, that traditionally there has been a lot of concern about isolation as people age. They may be farther away from their family. And also depression risk. There's a lot of research that has shown that our depression rates as we get older are higher. So anything that we can do to target, prevent, and help out reducing that depression risk in elderly is a good thing.
So even if isolation were roughly the same across demographics, there's still a greater concern about depression for older folks.
Exactly. You could think of it as sort of a double whammy, that depression rates are higher in the elderly, and that there's been a lot of research highlighting social isolation in that population too.
So you got a lot of people to work with here, 11,000, and I gather that they were surveyed several times, the same people every 2 years. Is a longitudinal kind of study then?
Exactly, yeah. That's what we call a longitudinal study in research. And so these are, again, Americans from all over the country. They participated in a particular study called the Health and Retirement Study, and the data is gathered and the sort of center of the research study is out of University of Michigan. But the data are open to the public, so researchers like myself or anyone else who's inclined can use that publicly available data to answer these, you know, important health questions.
So for the survey participants, are they self-assessing either depression or isolation?
Yeah, they are for both. The depression was determined via interview, but again, it's based I'm trained as a psychiatrist, and the way that we evaluate depression is largely based on a clinical interview with a patient. So that's similar to how depression was assessed with this. It's questions that are asked about a person's mood, their energy, sleep and motivation, things like that. And then also for social contact, it was based on someone's self-report of how often do I meet up or talk or so forth, so on and so forth with their friends and family.
We are talking about depression and isolation, particularly in seniors, with Dr. Alan Teo. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University and the lead author of a recently published report in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society about these very issues. You can join us on The Exchange with questions and comments, 800-838-3760 by phone across the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you talked about meeting up or making contact. And so generally, is there a particular way that people in the survey group tend to stay in touch with people? I mean, one predominant way?
You mean within those that are meeting up or meeting face-to-face?
Well, just in general. I mean, the contact, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So of those three core types of contact, so again, let me reiterate that it's phone contact, it's face-to-face meeting up in person, and then the third type is written contact, and that includes things like email and, you know, other ways that we can stay in touch by writing. Of those three core types, telephone contact was the most common. So the older adults were spending more time doing that with their family and friends. Second most common was face-to-face contact. And then the written was the least common.
And so how does the contact, the type of contact, track with the incidence of depression?
Absolutely. So the research shows, our findings show, that meeting up with your friends and family is essentially a strong preventive medicine for depression. So I think of it as trying to get a regular dose, like you might get your vitamins or medications. Make sure that you get regular face-to-face contact. We did not find any connection with depression risk based on how often you stayed in touch with friends and family on the phone or how often you had written contact. So it was really that this face-to-face contact had this clear relationship. The more often that you had face-to-face contact, the lower your risk of depression 2 years later.
All right, so neither of the other two types even came close then?
Exactly. It was much more of like a random relationship for the phone and the email written contact.
All right, let's take a call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Alan Teo from OHSU.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Alan. Well, this is sort of a personal testimonial. As a person pushing 60, I have a history of bipolar and anxiety disorders, and when I was having a crisis, it was all well and good to get mail or a phone call or an email, but for me personally, especially with regard to one of my siblings who was there for me, nothing beats a hug, gentlemen. So that's about all I had to say about it.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it. So he's totally backing up what you're talking about, Alan.
Yeah, I agree. And when I think about my research and trying to develop studies, I always try and think about it in three ways. Number one, what does the past research tell us? And you touched on that, how social isolation is bad. What do my patients tell me? Of course, Jamie isn't one of my patients, but I think of patients that I've seen with depression, or even those without depression but might be at risk for depression. And they also share, again, this discussion about whether they can meet up with their family or whether they're far away and they can only talk on the phone. And then I also can apply and think about these things in my own life. Do they make common sense to me?
Does the quality of the FaceTime itself make much of a difference? I mean, whether there is touching involved or anything like that, or is it just a matter of being in the physical presence of another person in three dimensions that makes the difference?
Yeah, I guess I would pull that apart in a couple different ways. One is that we weren't able to assess specifically whether physical touch or things like that were occurring in the face-to-face contact. Again, I think it's fair to say from examples like the one that Jamie brings up that you're able to do that and that's happening. And so that probably has some sort of benefit. If we had some of our biologic researchers, those that study some of the body chemistry, things like oxytocin, which is known as one of these chemicals that often
gets released. It's the bonding hormone?
Yeah, exactly. Colloquially referred to that. So maybe you get more of a burst of oxytocin. I think that would be a fantastic research question to sort of follow up on this. But the other thing that we do know is that the quality of your relationship with that person, whether again it's a family or friend or neighbor or coworker, that has a real impact. So the suggestion here is not to spend lots of time. I mean, this sounds intuitive, but the idea here is not to spend lots and lots of time with people that are going to be a stress to you, you know, if you're going to get into arguments or feel like they're nagging you, but people that you, again, feel supported by.
All right, so that leads to the question I had a little lower down the list about if the relationships have their problems, is it worth your time? And if it's a better than nothing thing, and it sounds like no, it's really not.
Actually, that is one of the previous studies that I've worked on, which is that, yeah, if it's a stressful relationship, you're probably better off not spending lots of time socializing or, of course, working on that issue, working on making that communication better and more healthy.
Dr. Alan Teo, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Alan Teo, MD, MS. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University, the lead author of a recent report about isolation and depression in senior citizens. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org. I take it back, not just senior citizens, but older adults, 50-plus. Let's take a call from Ann in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alan Teo.
Thank you. I've had a friend for years who has always told me that I'm her only friend. There's never been any problem in the relationship. We don't argue about anything. When we've gotten together, we just always have a good time. But in the last few months, she hasn't answered the phone. And when I leave a message, I don't get any response. I happen to run into her in a situation, and she was just as friendly as always and stuff like this. And anyway, I'm worried about her, you know, she's retired. I'm worried about her becoming even less social than she's always been. And what do you do in that situation?
When somebody seems to be self-isolating?
Exactly. What can a friend do to help that person not be so isolated?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Alan, thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think you brought up making telephone calls, and that wasn't leading. You weren't getting responses, but you managed to bump into the friend. And so, again, I think that comes back to one of the key research findings here is that when you are face-to-face, there's a more potent effect there. And so if there were ways that you could stop by your friend's house, make the effort to reach out in person, that would be helpful. One other tip would relate to opportunities to participate in social activities or groups or other things. So, this is relevant, again, for folks where they may not have a lot of friends, I think, like you bring up, or they may be farther away from family. But when I moved, I'm here in Portland, when I moved to this area, I didn't have family close by. I made sure to join a sports club, and I get to play games, racket sport games with friends, and they have become friends, really, through doing that. So if there are any opportunities to develop meetups, social activities that your friend could be invited to, I think that would be another tip in addition to trying to physically reach out and spend time with him or her.
Would, for example, for the retired person that Ann talks about, or for any retired person, I guess, volunteerism? I mean, if it's a working kind of thing, is that not the same or not the same quality as a social situation?
No, I would agree, Jeff, that whether it's volunteer or work, it doesn't really matter whether you're retired or not retired. It's just as long as ideally you would want to find an activity that the person is already interested in. So as a friend, you probably have a good sense of things that they've enjoyed historically, maybe when they were feeling better, mm-hmm. and sort of making arrangements so that they could participate in a gardening group or a group that plays cards, whatever it might be.
And then, you know, over the course of the years since this survey's begun to pull in information, there's been a further onslaught of technologies that make it easier for people to contact each other and look at each other. I mean, we've got Skype, we've got FaceTime, we've got all the ways in which people can do video chats now. And I wonder if that entered into what was pulled in through the survey questions this time around or at any point.
Yeah, so the survey asked about written contact. It specified emails, and it's sort of up to the survey respondent to decide whether they would think sending a text counts as written contact or a message on Facebook, whether that would count. So if you were responding to the survey, Jeff, and you said, oh, yeah, that sounds like written contact to me, then to that extent it would have been included. Some of the research that I'm trying to develop right now is going to specifically pull out things like social media and say how much are folks using them, and what sort of relationship does it have with their mental health.
From my own perspective, it seems like the baby boomers have really taken to Facebook, and they may be scaring younger generations away in the process. But I'm talking specifically about things like video chat, like Skype, where you can look at someone on the other end of a screen. It's electronic communication, but it seems like it might go a little further than the phone in making somebody feel like they're at least in the presence of another human being.
Exactly, yeah. So that we didn't get the answer to that in this study, but I think you bring up exactly sort of one of the next studies that we need to look at is that video chat option. In the hospital world, in the clinical world that I'm working with, we do a lot of telephone care, but we also are doing more sort of video-based visits, and that can particularly be helpful for folks that are farther, you know, live in more rural environments and can connect with the doctor who may be in more of a place like Portland.
Let's take a couple more minutes with Dr. Alan Teo from Oregon Health and Science University, assistant professor of psychiatry there and a researcher at the VA Portland Healthcare System. We're talking about the results of a piece he published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society about mode of contact for older adults feeling isolated and potentially leading to depression. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Jim writes, I'm 72 and can relate to a lot of this discussion. I have recently enjoyed the joy of having gotten a dog. I wonder if that entered into the survey questions at any point about the getting some quality FaceTime with a non-human.
I'm a pet lover myself. I have a Vizsla dog who is an important part of my life. But no, the survey was specifically with humans, with people.
All right. Now, even though it is about the face-to-face contact with people, is there a quality of relationship level here? I mean, we talked about the fact that if it's a stressful relationship, not a particularly good thing. But how well do you need to know the person? I mean, can contact with having a nice chat with the grocery clerk boost you a little bit, or does it really have to be somebody you know?
You know, from the research, this was asking about people's friends and family. So it wasn't asking about sort of those more casual acquaintances. You know, I would think that could lead to a friendship. Again, we don't choose our family, but we do choose our friends. And so to the extent that we can sort of build that social relationship up, I think it's very, very helpful.
Alan, and I haven't asked whether people can still feel a sense of isolation even if they do live with someone. Is that part of the issue too?
Yeah, that's a good question. And one sort of point of clarification for this study was that we were asking, or the survey questions asked, about social contact with people you do not live with. It's probably, if you think to your own life, it's probably hard to count the number of times or the number of hours that you've spent on the phone with someone that you already live with. Those folks that you live with were not the folks that we were accounting for the social contact in this study.
Okay, so more or less factored out. And does age or age range matter much? I mean, is it pretty even once you get past 50, or does it get more acute as the years grow longer?
Do you mean in terms of the social contact or the depression or
general? The depression isolation part of it, yes.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty consistent across that age range. Again, the key was just that if you had more in-person contact, if you had, for instance, contact at least three times a week, your chance of having that clinically significant level of depression 2 years later was about 6.5%. And for people that had contact every few months or less, they were on sort of the other end of being much more isolated, their risk was about twice that, at about 11.5%.
All right, so a greater risk there. Were the people who did report isolation and depression in the survey, was it just a fact-finding thing, or were they advised to make some changes, get some help?
Yeah, it was more of a fact-finding mission. So I tend to try and do studies like this and then think about how I can apply it into future work, of course, with patients, but also in terms of developing programs or interventions.
There's a fair amount of this, obviously, that had been studied at least in part before, and I wonder if for you, Alan, there were any particular surprises in what turned up.
There was one big surprise. I did expect that the face-to-face or in-person contact was probably going to be the most potent, so I was, I guess you could say, relieved that was the most important effect here. But I was surprised that the telephone contact didn't show a relationship with depression. So as people had phone contact again on a weekly basis or more frequently, we didn't see lower depression rates. There was one important exception to that, which is the folks that had a pre-existing history of depression. For those folks, if you already had a diagnosed history of depression or signs of depression in years past, having phone contact was good for you. The more frequently you talked with your friends or family, the lower your depression rate 2 years later.
Okay, but generally the phone not nearly as good for communications as face-to-face contact.
Exactly.
How quickly does a change in circumstances work? I wonder if that was reflected here. I mean, if people do make a point of getting more face-to-face contact, is there any indication of how quickly a feeling of either isolation or depression can turn around?
Yeah, well, I think both isolation as well as depression typically develop gradually. So our earlier caller, I think, who was speaking about sort of gradually noticing this friend becoming more isolated. So these effects are really powerful effects from isolation and depression. They affect our quality of life, our ability to function even on a day-to-day basis. So they are powerful effects, but they tend to accrue over time.
So the effects will get worse as the isolation continues.
Exactly. And so there have been studies, in fact, that have shown our mortality, our length of life is reduced by having more social isolation. So to the extent that people can incorporate this in their daily life, think about opportunities to reach out and meet up instead of placing the phone call. If you do that in your daily life, that's going to reduce your depression risk for years to come, I think.
Okay, face-to-face contact, a big difference from either on the phone contact or anything written, that's email or text. Dr. Alan Teo is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University and a researcher at the VA Portland Healthcare System. The survey is called, Does Mode of Contact with Different Types of Social Relationships Predict Depression in Older Adults? Evidence from a nationally representative survey. Dr. Teo, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff. Enjoy the conversation.
All right. Take care.